Everybody, this is Tracy. Today I've got the coolest guest ever. For any of you who have ever read Jackson McKenzie's Psychopath Free book, to me, this is the standard for learning about them. And when I read and listened over and over to Psychopath Free, my life unfolded in a way of discovering who I was dealing with and what had been going on my entire life. So Jackson has got a new book coming out that is all about healing after this kind of abuse and healing these emotional wounds that we get. So without any further ado, let's welcome Jackson, because I think you guys are going to love him. And I want you to go buy his new book because it's on healing and we need that. So let's welcome Jackson.
Hi, Tracy. Thank you for having me.
I am so excited because for those of people out there in YouTube land that don't know Jackson, he only got a small amount of videos on his YouTube channel, but he is the author of Psychopath Free. And he is soon to be the author of a new book. What's the book's name?
It's called Whole Again, and it's for people who are looking to look at long-term recovery from toxic relationships, emotional abuse, and any sort of childhood wound that might be left over.
I think that's so needed, the healing process for us. Isn't it very similar on all the people? I mean, we kind of go through the same stages of recovery.
Yeah, absolutely. And even with the phases of the narcissistic relationship recovery, like you say, we really find that there's a lot of patterns and commonalities there. And I found something really similar with that inner healing that we do in the long term is after talking with like thousands of people from the psychopath recovery world, codependency, complex PTSD, all of these different areas, is that that process was also very similar for a lot of people.
Yeah, I would imagine. And for me, the sad part is, and I don't know if you've come into this sort of thing, is I want to say the damage that untrained professionals can do in this healing process.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm an untrained non-professional, so there's your double whammy. But I encourage people to seek out therapy, but you're so right that you need someone who is really skilled and understanding in this specific topic. Someone who's going to help you dig into, first of all, making sure you're safe and out of a manipulative or controlling relationship. And secondly, someone who's going to be able to work with you to heal those long-term wounds so that you can be happy and that you can go have successful and really complete feeling relationships, or just being happy on your own is just so important.
Mm-hmm. Did you in your research, did you find that many people that have been in narcissistic, sociopath, psychopathic relationships had some kind of childhood exposure, like a parent or something? Do you find that to be?
Yeah, I think that's really common. And I think even one encounter, especially early on with one of these relationships, is enough to give you one of those wounds that can kind of keep leading down the same path. In childhood, especially, what I've found with a lot of people is just sometimes issues with one parent or two parents who they're very, basically their needs overshadow your own. And sometimes people think, well, my parent's not abusive. It's nothing like this relationship, or maybe they were worse. But the bottom line is, it doesn't have to be abusive. When you have someone whose needs constantly overshadow your own, that can take all sorts of forms. That can be someone who's controlling and domineering, someone who always has to be right, so you just learn to let them be right, someone who demands all of the sympathy and attention, someone who guilt trips you for having your own needs. And one thing I've really found is that a lot of people who deal with these relationships are they're constantly on alert and aware of when maybe a conflict is about to approach, or when maybe someone is upset, and they're preemptively trying to prevent that from happening, because things like anger and conflict are really anxiety inducing.
Right. And how do we try to prevent those things from happening? It's in our soul to, you know, oh, let me fix that. But how do we prevent that?
So that, I think, is what you just said is so interesting, is it's in our soul, and that's really what it feels like. It's almost this thing that feels like it's a part of who we are, and it's not something that can be done with. But that anxiety and dread that comes up when we feel like we need to fix something, or that kind of like pity that we might feel when someone's super sympathetic, all the sad things that they've been through that tend to, again, lead to pretty unfortunate situations. All of that is really something that can be looked at, I think, with a combination of like mindfulness and therapy. And the more we explore the discomfort that arises when we sense a conflict bubbling over, the less we necessarily react as we kind of intend to. And that's our default, is to react and say, oh no, like we all like each other, make a funny joke or make fun of yourself or just anything to put an end to it. Instead of doing that, you just notice, oh, I feel like really awful right now and like afraid and I really don't want this to happen. And mindfulness just lets you notice that. It doesn't say you have to do anything or change anything. You just notice it and notice where the discomfort in your body is occurring.
A lot of people don't know what mindfulness is. Do you want to explain that really quickly?
Yeah. I love mindfulness. It's like there's so many great resources on it too. And Tara Brach is one of my favorite mindfulness coaches. But what I understand of it is that it is building up a non-judgmental observer of your thoughts and feelings and emotions in your body. So it's not looking at something as good or bad. It's not saying I need to heal or undo this or change this. All it is like, if you were to just imagine a friendly person looking over you, that sounds creepy. How about like a friendly presence? It was just, and all the only thing that's is there is just noticing, like, oh, that's interesting. Huh. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. It's not, oh, I shouldn't be feeling that. If I had made progress, I wouldn't feel that. That's all like the kind of more ingrained emotional issues. Whereas the observer is something we build. It's like any other exercise that you would do, is the more you practice it, the more it becomes easier to get into that.
Mm-hmm. And are there different roles? Because I know you made a video about the protector, for example.
Yeah. So I think a lot of times when we have emotional wounds stored, we'll see different parts of ourselves that pop up to try to compensate for that wounding. And a lot of times that distractor just basically keeps us, it's trying to protect from the wound, but it keeps us constantly like on a hamster wheel, just always looking for what's next. What am I doing next? Maybe it's accomplishments. Maybe it's substance abuse. Maybe it's helping others to the point of it being more caretaking rather than just regular help. Perfectionism, all of these kinds of things that just keep you super externally focused and away from the body. Mm-hmm. And so when people ask, how can I identify if I have some unresolved emotional wounding? The first thing I say is to just take a little bit of an inventory of your life and see, are you maybe distracted or just constantly going? It can be even as simple as like being a workaholic or something. It's keeping your mind going a million miles an hour, and the truth in the body kind of gets numbed out.
And that's sort of masking, by being a workaholic or an alcoholic or something, you're actually masking the wound, right?
Exactly. And so many people will say, well, I don't have a wound. I mean, I'm fine. I never think about my relationship anymore. I never think about my childhood anymore. But emotional wounds are really tricky, especially when you get into the realm with complex PTSD, where those things stay inside you and dictate everything that you think, do, feel, even your approach to healing. And so they're very tricky, and they kind of can convince you that, especially because things are numbed out, that pretty much everything is fine. You don't need to worry. Just keep doing that one more job thing. Keep doing that one more this, and then you'll be fine.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And so these core wounds from this emotional abuse, how do we identify? So you had a narcissistic parent, or you were in a relationship, and are they core wounds like codependency? Are they core wounds like people pleasing, things like that? Or are those a result of the wound?
Yeah, I think codependency and people pleasing would be a really solid example of that wounding. You look at someone who's codependent, a lot of times there's this underlying worthlessness. The book Codependent No More, she talks a lot about that too. Mm-hmm. That sense that you're not enough and that you need to take care of others to have worth. And Again, it's all a distraction. It sounds a lot better, obviously, than many other distractions, like doing drugs, because you're helping people, but it causes the same damage to you because it's all about other people's needs being met. And another example I think that a lot of people who've been in a narcissistic relationship would resonate with is that most of those tend to end in some pretty blatant infidelity. A lot of times you're rapidly replaced with another person, and they're waving that person in your face and saying how happy they are and how great their life is, you know, the whole song and dance. So when something like that happens, it's so humiliating and so unnerving, and you're still trying to figure out what's going on. And I think it's easy to jump to, oh, there's something wrong with that person, or I'm better than that person, or all that. But a lot of times there's something that's already been absorbed after that fact, because a trusted loved one has replaced you with someone else. And that is really bound to cause some inadequacy and rejection, and just a general sense that who you are as you is not enough. Other people are better.
Right. And shame. I mean, that's the biggest thing that people wear on their hat is, you know, that is so embarrassing, and that is hurtful. And when someone does cheat on you, it puts you into such a spiral that shame becomes something that you wear as your, I don't know, armor.
Yeah. I mean, it becomes like a core part of yourself that you feel defective, and like some part of you needs to be hidden from the world. And that's really painful.
Yeah, but that's not true. They're not worthless. So how do they claim it back?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think I've always believed that like there are so many different paths towards healing and recovery. And I tried to cover as many as I could in the new book, but really what worked for me and what I found worked for a lot of people from all walks of life is first using that mindfulness to slow down on the distractions, figure out what's going on there. Start to experience the discomfort in the body, wherever that may be, the heart, the chest, the core, and really start to get in touch with that sensation. Is you don't need to tell a story around it. You don't need to try to analyze it. That's more of like the psychological side of like, oh, I must do this because my mother did this or my ex did this. And we're actually trying to get out of the analytical mode when we do that wound healing, because we're trying to go more towards what the body is feeling. And when we get to that core wounding, whether that be rejection or worthlessness or inadequacy, whatever that shame is, I think the first step is just sitting with it and realizing, I think we mentioned with Tara Brock, she says, it's real but not true. So you're not pretending it's not there. That doesn't work well. But you're recognizing it's there and considering the possibility that might not be true. It could be this relentless voice saying, no, it's all your fault. You're actually the crazy one. You're bad. Like, you need to admit that you're bad, and everyone's going to fight. Like, those kinds of nasty shame voices are the ones that we need to listen to. And then we can get to the more fun aspect of letting it go.
Mm-hmm. And letting it go is the hardest part. I would think that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but people that, are ready to heal these wounds are further along on the recovery journey. I like to call the new people like fresh out of the oven, like the anger, the hurt, that can they heal when they're there, or they have to understand more before they can start to address the healing process?
Oh yeah. I mean, I've definitely been there too, the fresh out of the oven, and it's a, everything is so volatile, and there's a lot of need for validation with other people who have been through something similar. I think all of us can look back at a time when we're watching a million YouTube videos, reading a million books, and really just like absorbing as much knowledge as possible. And I think that is an essential step in the journey. But looking back, it's hard to say if it can be done or should be done. I don't see myself really being able to juggle those two things at once, because my focus and my purpose at the time was more dedicated to that that other stuff. And I think as time passed, I just became interested also in these other topics.
Yeah. The same thing happened with me. I mean, you know, when you're like smack with all of it and you know nothing about narcissists, sociopaths, psychopaths, you have to learn these red flags. You have to learn the behaviors, because that's going to be your guardian later to not get involved again, you know? So if you just like go, oh, I want to get healed. And I had a sweet young person come to me recently and she's like, can I just check into like a Betty Ford clinic and be done in a week? I'm like, I don't know, honey. I think we have to learn some stuff first and really understand how deep these tentacles go. Because, you know, when someone has been married for 17 years and then they find out that the person that they're with is this horrific, cheating, double-lifed person, that's a betrayal. They've got to deal with the betrayal, the abandonment. There's so many different pieces of the puzzle, in my opinion. I think we should have a big, giant puzzle and all these pieces should be covered. But as they're going through all of those stages, those are obviously necessary, but then they have to move on and have that interest. Why me? I've learned about them. What do I have? And the tentacles could be, oh my goodness, my family. Oh my goodness, I've had this before and I didn't learn the lesson. So I think that part is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of shifting that perspective of like, why do these bad things keep happening to me, towards like a more of like a healthy, like, oh, maybe this is like, this has got to be an opportunity. Like if especially with patterns, I mean, it's hard to call like, get out of a 17-year relationship with someone who's abusive. I wouldn't call that like an opportunity, but looking for this silver lining is when those things keep happening and the patterns keep recurring, I see that as us getting a chance to kind of look at what's going on and kind of find a healthier path forward. Look at, for example, if you're carrying around some deep sense of worthlessness or inadequacy or rejection, it's going to be really easy for other manipulative people to kind of keep grasping onto you, because there's that low barrier to entry where they're just obsessed with you up front. You don't have to do anything. They just love you. They don't even know who you are. They just love you. And that feels really good at first until you realize they can just love anyone. So, and I should put love in big, big quotes.
They targeted you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think when we shift the perspective, instead of just like, because we have to learn those red flags, but also, like you said, internally in ourselves, when we start to experiment with removing those wounds that have maybe been there for a really long time, I think we find that boundaries almost come automatically, because you start to like this person that you're helping out with your mindfulness and your exploration. And you're like, hey, I want the best for this person. I don't need them to have to put up with abuse or manipulation for a few months and then eventually blow up and get mad. And then everyone's like, oh, you're crazy. I want to like be able to upfront when someone's being manipulative or mean, just say, hey, that doesn't work for me. That's not okay. Like pretty much like anyone would say. And what you're going to find is that doesn't magically change other people. Other people stay mostly the way they're going to stay unless they really commit to getting better. But you're going to find that those dynamics go away really quickly, because it's very hard to have a successful relationship with a toxic person if you're feeling good yourself.
Absolutely. And I think these core wounds are not, they're not visible. I think they're definitely invisible under there. And certainly in the beginning, survivors are, you know, they're surviving, but they're not looking deep, deep, you know, yeah. Again, like the girl who wants to go to the Betty Ford clinic and make it better, you know, yeah. I'll learn what I got to do, but do it in a week. It's stuff that is almost how we were made. It's the beliefs that we had as a child, or things that might have happened. You know, sometimes a bully in the schoolyard when you were a kid could put this core wound in you.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the most interesting things to realize, is that as resilient as humans are, there's also that vulnerability to that wounding, especially as a young person. I think the bullying example you brought up is great. And even in Tara Brach's book, she talks about a little girl who didn't want to get her hair cut, and her mom made her, and she started crying, and her mom said, no, you have to do this. And that was her whole, for like the rest of her life, was she just kept giving everyone else whatever they wanted, and she gets so angry because she never got what she wanted. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't know the truth or fiction in that story, but I think it's just worth looking back and not trying to, you know, hyper-analyze anything, but just to learn about ourselves and to start to like that person.
As you were talking, I had this flashback of my childhood, I had this favorite pair of purple pants. They were ugly. They were purple. They were corduroy, you know, big, thick corduroy in those days. And I don't know why they were worn out or something. My mother made me throw them. She threw them out. And it was like horrific to me. So much so that at 9 years old, I ate a bottle of baby aspirin and wanted to die.
Oh my God. Oh,
yes. So, yes. You know, pumped my stomach. I was fine. Obviously it was orange flavored, but, that thing was just such an important part of losing control, not having control of my purple pants or having my favorite thing was taken away from me. So that's probably in there with all my little wound soup.
Yeah. And you lose your own agency and start to adopt instead more of a negative self-concept. And that's really what can plummet us into more of that sense of victimhood. And when I say victimhood, it always has such a negative connotation. I don't mean it that way, because if something horrible happens to you, you're abused or something like that, you have been victimized. But I think victim mindset is a different thing that we can absorb ourselves, which is that these bad things happen to us and that nothing can change. And that is such a helpless and really unhappy, scary feeling. And I think as we start to take the reins in our own recovery and healing, we start to step beyond that role and we realize, like, hey, maybe this person in my life always bossed me around or always controlled everything, but that's not the case anymore. Or if it is, I'm going to get out of it. And I'm my boss now. I'm going to take care of this. And it feels a lot better. You realize you don't have to be afraid of other humans and how they might react to you. It's not our job to be on the lookout for that.
No, I know that people have a hard time. I made a video with Richard Cranon and Dana and Angie talking about victimhood and victim and living in victim. So I think people have held on to that victim, and it's a trophy. It's something that protects them, and they hold on to it, and they go around, I'm a victim, so therefore I can, you know, even a narcissistic person, they were a victim of some sort of trauma in their lives. But they hold that victimhood and they're going to never have it happen again.
So right. It's like a badge, like a get out of jail free card. And you're right. You see that the worst of the worst when it comes to cluster B disorders is they'll kick you, hurt you while you're down and all that stuff. And then they are the ones who say that they're being victimized by you. And I think that's why that mentality can be so toxic. And we sort of get sucked into, I think it's called the drama triangle, where it's the drama of betrayal, where there's a victim, a rescuer, and a perpetrator. And wherever you fall on that map with the cluster B relationships and the codependency, the cycle just always repeats itself. If you're rescuing someone, inevitably they might just start seeing you as the perpetrator. If you're feeling victimized and someone comes along to rescue you, they might end up being a complete horrible person after. And it just kind of, it's this dance that we keep dancing until we take a step back, and it's like that meta awareness that comes with mindfulness. And we say, I don't want to dance this dance anymore. I don't want anyone to save me. I certainly don't want to save anyone else. I want to figure myself out, and I want my relationships to reflect that.
I think that's such a big part of recovery is just taking that step that I don't want to be this way anymore. I'm done, you know, with the drama. I'm done with talking about the drama. Let me just do and learn. And I think that's when we hit that point where we go and we're like, okay, you know what do I have to do? I have to learn this. I have to learn that. I have to understand. I have to be aware of my surroundings.
Yeah.
And that's such a big part.
Yeah. And it's like, it can be overwhelming, but also like really exciting because it's a whole new step in the process. And I think one of the biggest things that can hold someone back is you've talked about like complex PTSD. And that can be really frustrating and disheartening because one of the quotes I saw that I loved about PTSD is that it's not that the person is refusing to let go of the past. It is that the past is refusing to let go of the person. And it can be so angering because you want nothing more than to be done with this whole process, let it go. But something maybe in your body or that hypervigilance or alert just keeps it stuck and it keeps ruminating or it keeps just manifesting itself or it keeps repeating the same patterns. And I think that's where a lot of times I see people give up or get just so mad. And I got really frustrated too, because I was like, I've had this like numb feeling in my heart for like 5 years. I've done everything I could possibly imagine. Like, what do you want from me? And I just want to offer a message of hope to anyone who maybe resonates with that, that it is not the end. It's not even close to the end. There's always hope.
There's always hope, and we can rewrite the story. I very often use a book as an example that this was a chapter in your life. Your chapter when you were in high school and you had all those friends, but well, maybe you have a few, but you don't have them all. So that chapter's done. Next chapter is this. Well, after abuse, the next chapter is whatever you want it to be. And that we have the crayons. I wrote that, I did a video on that, and we can make the story up. What do we want to do? And for a lot of people, they don't know what their passion is. They've been controlled for so long, like a little marionette puppet, that they don't know how to find it. And so I think that learning mindfulness, learning boundaries, you know, all of these things, it's sort of like a checklist. Let's just heal.
Yeah, I love that book metaphor. That's so good. And being able to say next chapter is on me. I'm gonna figure this one out. That's really cool.
And take control of it. It's when we feel like we don't have control. And fear is such a big part. We're afraid of tomorrow because we don't know it. Yeah. And so we are afraid of that chapter. But what if you wrote the chapter out? What if you said, this is my goal. This is what I want to do. I want to have this. And for people in my age bracket, they're like, okay, I'm over 50 and I have to start again. And I say, we get half our life back. You know, yeah. I mean, it's so easy. And for years I was like, oh my God, I won't be able to retire. My life is over. And that fear. But I'm like, but what was that doing? That made me lose all those years going, well, shit, I don't have to retire yet, but I can like live for today and have a good time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's paralyzing. And you're right. Like in any age group, it gives you that feeling that, oh no, it's stuck or it's never going to be able to go back. I remember when I was chatting with my friend and I was like, oh my gosh, like I'm almost 30 and I feel like I've just like wasted all this time, like, you know, thinking about like the narcissist and like all this stuff. And I just want to be like a normal 20 something year old. I just want to like do what normal 20 something year olds do. And he's like, why don't you just do that then? I was like, oh, so I told you, I like joined softball leagues and tennis leagues and started just like playing sports, like going out with friends and like all of the stuff. And I was like, oh yeah, that's doable.
It's just finding what you want to do and just do it. You know, yeah. I tell people that in my groups all the time. It's just like, what, like, did you like to bake? Then go bake me cookies. I love cookies. Bring them in.
Yeah, that's actually, yeah, that's a double win.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all about healing, but I really want to thank you so much. When can people expect to see your book?
So Whole Again comes out. This is like the fifth time I've forgotten when Whole Again comes out. I think it's the 8th or the 14th or the 18th. And I'm really sorry about
that.
But it's already of January. Yeah. And it's available though for pre-order on Amazon.
Well, I suggest that everyone get it. And I hope that it comes out on audio as well. Because your audio book of Psychopath Free was like, you were talking about people, you know, really playing detective and listening to things all the time. That was my first audiobook, and I just listened to it driving and driving and driving, and it was my friend. And I hope that this other one to help people heal will also be able to reach me for that.
That means a lot to me, because you've obviously become friends for a ton of people who are seeking support now too. So it's amazing to see that connection.
Yeah, well, you've helped a lot, and this community has. I find that people who are in this community, who have been through it, are so kind and so loving, and they give back.
Everyone wants to give back. Yeah, it's really inspiring.
It is. I know. It's awesome. So we have to watch out for the narcissists that are pretending to give back.
Yeah, that's never super fun.
It's like, wait a second. You say you do all these charities, but when? I don't know. Actions, yeah, we'll speak louder one day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you so much for joining me. And we'll look forward to your book. And everybody get out there and buy that book, because it's going to be awesome, because you have done an amazing job before. So looking forward to it.
Thank you, Stacey.